Welcome to the Taming Tribulation Podcast. I am your host, Wyatt Hammond.
And I'm your co-host, Jeremy Crossley.
In Season 2, we are using biblical stories about trials and tribulations that characters have gone through, how they confronted them and overcame their own personal obstacles, so they can become the people that God uses for His purpose. Not perfect people, but imperfect people being used to do His will.
Our intention with these stories is to pass on to the listener the understanding that God uses the hardest and most difficult moments in our lives to refine us into the people we were meant to be.
We hope that you can be encouraged to see where God can use your tribulations for His purpose. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Taming Tribulation. In this episode, Jeremy and I will be starting in 2 Samuel chapter 15. Before we do that, we'll give you a quick recap of what's happened up to this point in the story. In our last episode, we finished at chapter 14 in 2 Samuel, and we're skipping 14 to 15 because this is an easy part of the story to just recap. So where we are in the story is David, king of Israel, has had his son Absalom kill his other son, Amnon. And after he killed his brother, after Absalom killed his brother, he was banished from the kingdom. Chapters 14 to 15 cover how Absalom was allowed back. And the way that happened was Joab, a general of King David, knew that Absalom wanted to come back and knew that David wanted his son to come back. So the general Joab sent a woman to convince King David to allow his son to come back. And the way she did that was by kind of making him see his own hypocrisy. So once David allows Absalom to come back, a couple years pass. Absalom has now returned to Jerusalem and is waiting to reconcile with his father, King David. So the reason that Jeremy and I are skipped 14 to 15 is because that's an easy chapter to recap. And the reason that we're continuing on in 15 is because that is it's a very important beginning to a new part of the story, where now Absalom is turning against his father and David is having more difficulties come his way. So starting in chapter 15 of 2 Samuel, in the course of time, Absalom provided himself with a chariot and horses, and with 50 men to run ahead of him. He would get up early and stand by the side of the road leading to the city gate. Whenever anyone came with a complaint to be placed before the king for a decision, Absalom would call out to him, "What town are you from?" He would answer, "Your servant is from one of the tribes of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your claims are valid and proper, but there is no representative of the king to hear you." And Absalom would add, "If only I were appointed judge in the land, then everyone who has a complaint or case would come to me and I would see that they received justice." Also, whenever anyone approached him to bow down before him, Absalom would reach out his hand and take hold of him and kiss him. Absalom behaved in this way toward all the Israelites who came to the king asking for justice. And so he stole the hearts of the people of Israel. At the end of 4 years, Absalom said to the king, "Let me go to Hebron and fulfill a vow I made to the Lord. While your servant was living at Geshur in Aram, I made this vow. If the Lord takes me back to Jerusalem, I will worship the Lord in Hebron." The king said to him, "Go in peace." So he went to Hebron. Then Absalom sent secret messengers throughout the tribes of Israel to say, "As soon as you hear the sound of the trumpets, then say, 'Absalom is king in Hebron.'" 200 men from Jerusalem accompanied Absalom. They had been invited as guests and went quite innocently, knowing nothing about the matter. While Absalom was offering sacrifices, he also sent for Ahithophel, the Gilonite, David's counselor, to come from Gilo, his hometown. And so the conspiracy gained strength, and Absalom's following kept on increasing. So, Jeremy, at this point in the story, David has had so much mercy on his son for killing his brother. He murdered his brother, ran into hiding, and David shows him enough mercy to bring him back into his kingdom and into his family. And now we're starting to see Absalom is starting to a conspiracy. He's starting to be the judge of the land and making people kiss his ring. And what do you think is going on here? Why is he doing this?
Well, you know, the first thing that I just see is like David can never catch a break.
Right.
The guy has just been on and on and on. Just something's going wrong. And he's going back and forth, back and forth. And I think this is just out of what, you know, what happens, like we talked about at the beginning, what happens when we submit to our own will rather than God's will. And all these things, unfortunately, have to happen to humble us. But the first thing I saw was just like, Absalom's like, how bold do you got to be to do something like that and try to take over your father's, you know, kingdom while he's still alive? Like, I can't, right. I don't know how old David is in this, but I know it's probably not so far off.
There's still quite a bit of the time in the story.
Yeah. And we don't have a timeline of that, but I can only imagine like going out every morning with a bunch of guys and like greeting the people and saying like, if I was appointed king, I'd help you guys. And you can imagine for 4 years or 5 years, whatever, how long it was 4 years. Every morning, how many people came through. So he was building a big following of like, oh, you know, maybe the competency of David isn't as good. So like, now we're going to see if Absalom could do it. Mm-hmm. In which it works in his favor. I mean, he then, you know, tells his father that he's going to go worship at Hebron, and then he takes one of his advisors and kind of like sneaks him into the fold. Which to me, I'm just really surprised how bold Absalom is, but it also shows like how crooked man can become once they feel like they have power. A little thing I've always known, just like what men, like why do men fall in general? Mostly it's either power, greed, or love. And that's literally the trifecta. And I think we've seen all three of these in both David's life and Absalom's life. But I think it's just bizarre. It's good that David let him in, but it's also good that kind of David is being shown like, dude, like you just can't catch a break and you got to keep surrendering yourself to God. And a lot of people in these times are kind of like, well, why do you have to go through all these things in order for it to be shown? It's like, David is probably a very stubborn guy. that's what I thought was wild about this. And Absalom just being as corrupt and crooked, like going against his own father. It's just surprising to me, taking advantage of him. I mean, I could say I'm surprised, but I can also say I'm not surprised because of just the chaos they've done, you know?
Yeah, it's kind of what humans do, is do the worst things we can really think of when we have the opportunity to. But it also seems like he's just like not even that smart about it, right? Like there's more intelligent ways to start a conspiracy than just telling people, oh, I would be a better judge, right? And it
yeah. Takes
4 years and then you still fail. Like,
yeah.
So it's like he should have known who he's going up against. It's like you're going up against David, your father, number one, and God.
Yeah.
Like if God wants you to be king, you'll be king.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be you having to tell people for 4 years, hey, look at me, what a good judge I am.
Yeah.
And going behind your father's back. Like what a dirty, schemey thing to do. And then you don't even do it intelligently.
Well, it blinds people, right? It reminds you of like the average politician, right? They tell you, oh, we're going to be here for you. We're going to help you. We're going to do this. And then when they get it, like none of it really happens as much as they want it to happen. You know what I mean? And it's like they're using schemes to try to get people. I'm not saying all politicians like that, but most of them are. They use schemes to try to get people to essentially conform to them. And then when they get that power, then it's like, all right, what are you going to do about it? But I mean, it's, you'd be surprised how many people are convinced by something as unintelligent as these little things he tries to do to win them over. And people fall for it all the time. And we don't know obviously the societal, like what's going on with Israel, right? Or Jerusalem. We don't know what's going on with like what's like the poverty level or like how many people or like the sacrifices and stuff. Like a lot of people made sacrifices just for a show, right? So we don't know what's going on as far as the culture nowadays. So maybe they just think David's only out for himself. Well, King David's only out for himself. So maybe we need a new king. And people can relate that with their own lives, right? Whenever you have someone who's been your boss for 20 years, you're like, all right, we need some new blood. So I think that's probably the mentality of the people. And you know how chit chat goes. Like you tell one person, they tell one person, they tell 10 people, they tell 100 people. And it goes from that one person knowing to 10,000 people knowing within a short period of time and you convince the world, right?
To drink it away. And the day of the internet, and you look at, yeah, I mean, you make a fair point that how easily convinced people are, and especially like it could just be there's a well established king that has all of this moral authority and history in the civilization with David and Goliath, and everybody knows how David got to that point. And so his son now starts telling people, I would be a better judge. It's not like he hasn't killed any giant. He hasn't ever fought in a battle for God or anything. And he's saying, I would be a better judge. And so people start believing it. And so, you know, it's like, it's easy to look back at these people and think, oh, you guys must be so stupid to just believe what this kid says and not take all of the things that have happened up to this point more seriously. But we look at today's society, people are convinced of anything, right? Like there's a great saying I heard the other day. I think it was by D.K. Chesterton, but if I'm misquoting him, then sorry. But it's when people stop believing in God, they don't believe in nothing. They believe in anything.
Yeah.
And it's exactly that. Like, and that's in today's society, right? People stop believing in God, and suddenly you think anybody can be any gender, any time, and suddenly you think any truth that you think about, that you think for yourself, is truth to the rest of the world, and it's completely preposterous. So it's like, even in today's society, we can't look back at these people and think, oh, you guys were so stupid. They would look at us and think, oh my gosh, you guys
are
way out of your minds. Like, you believe anything you're told. So it's helpful to
Wild too, you know. It's crazy you say that too, because like I had a conversation with someone the other day about, like, they were like asking me if I thought there was human life outside of our galaxy. And I asked, I use the same thing with people all the time. I ask people, it's like, how do you know this? We're the only galaxy, or there's other galaxies? I was like, we physically can't know. We don't have actual evidence. We just have scientists saying things. We don't have actual evidence. We can't physically go to another galaxy. And they were like, yeah, but we just know. And I'm like, but how do you know if there's no facts? And I was essentially telling them, like, their faith in scientists or what give them that mentality that other things are the way they are. But what's more realistic? Like, and this is how I was convinced on a logical level of God's existence. It's like, I can believe in all these things that man says, but I can't believe like what a bunch of people who evidently died, and there's actual evidence about the creation of God and Jesus and the stories in the Bible. Like, why does the facts, why do I miss over the facts, but I can believe what a scientist says? And it's like, wake up. Like, you just want to live your own life. And that's just the excuse you want to use.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Well, and then anyone sitting there, any listeners right now thinking, oh my gosh, are these guys talking against science and saying you shouldn't listen to scientists? Wouldn't go that far, but I would say God's word is eternal, and scientists constantly change their mind.
Yes.
The biggest problem with the scientific community, certainly in my lifetime, and it's not going to end anytime soon, is that everybody has to agree, and any disagreements are shut down, and that's not science, right? They're not coming to the best answer. They're coming to the answer that they want. That's, you know, a very broad statement. I'm talking about certain types of science, not all, but you know, if you don't think that certain scientific opinions require faith, then you're out to lunch, right? Not all these things are proven. Even the things that they say aren't. They're lying to you. And if you don't believe me, send me an email. Let's have a conversation. So one other point I wanted to bring up in this part of the story is looking at David and Absalom's character, right? Like that we saw in David's story, his heroic side where he goes and fights Goliath and becomes king and does all these amazing things. And then we see his cowardice, sinful side where he sleeps with Bathsheba, kills her husband and does those horrible acts. And so we see both sides of the character. And then we see his son who kills his brother for raping his daughter, which maybe not like it's a very human reaction, and one that I'm not upset about. I I don't dislike Absalom for choosing to do that. But then he comes back and decides to conspire against his father for, after allowing him to come back into his kingdom. And it's so again, you see the heroic side and the sinful side of each of them. And that's the point we're trying to drive home with this, that's all of us. All of us have those heroic sides, and all of us have those terrible sides that when we choose to use them, it always goes poorly. So you see that in these guys, Jeremy?
Yeah, I mean, I can see that in myself and in anybody. I think as a society, like, it's hard to, like, I had conversations with a bunch of people recently about the distinction between, again, like, doing what's right and doing what's wrong. And obviously right and wrong is subjective, good or bad is subjective, but like, deep down inside, we know what we're doing is right or wrong. Like, it's, and you could argue, oh, that's cultural, but like, all right, let's skip the cultural aspect of it and go with what God says in his word. And I think it's just a great example of being reminded of, like, when we want to do the things we want to do rather than to do the things we're supposed to do, it doesn't go as well as it should. But I also think there's that level of, you always have an opportunity to come back. Always have an opportunity to come back. Even when you do something wrong, you could still come back, right? The consequences are probably going to be bad, but they're going to be much worse if you continue living your life.
Yeah.
And I think so many people, especially people who didn't grow up in like a religious or a Christian background.
Like yourself.
Like myself, yeah. Like I obviously didn't have that background, and I've known how many times I messed up based on what I thought was right. You know, and I kept being reminded, like, you're dumb. Not the right thing. And I knew it the entire time I was doing it, but I just didn't care enough to want to change. And honestly, I didn't really know how to change. And I was kind of like, well, okay, well, if this is all bad, then what's good? Everyone else around me is doing the same thing, so it can't be that bad, right? And then I realized, oh, this is just the darkness of the world and not the light of the world. And then I got to find out what that light of the world is. And I found it by accident, which makes it even more bizarre. It's like, okay, so what standard do I now live by? And it's not a perfect standard. Like, I'm not perfect. I don't live by it perfectly, but God's standard is the best standard. And it's not like my life has changed, you know, like, it's not always a prosperity thing. Like, if I give this life, it doesn't mean I'm going to be prosperous. Like, I've lost a career. I've lost, you know, my family, I lost my brother. And I still surrendered to what I thought was right and what God says is right. And do I struggle? Of course. But we got to be reminded that there's our way, which we may think is the right way. And then there's the actual correct way. And which way are we going to choose? Yep. And when are we going to realize our way doesn't work? And yeah,
just makes things take longer and be harder.
Yeah, it definitely does. And I like the reminder once again, like, it's over and over and over again. This isn't just like, oh, they messed up once. No, this is like a continuously mess up. And
murderers, like, and rapists and liars and cheaters and insurrectionists and plunderers. I mean, it's just like, seriously, dude, there's almost nothing that you can think of horrible that these people didn't do.
Yeah. this is King David.
Right.
And this is the guy that was on the hilltop who killed the giant that everyone was scared of, who was the sheep herder. He was the last of the sons. He was the nobody who became somebody and fell over and over and over and over again. And that's why it's like, if he falls, anybody can fall.
So one thought that came to mind while you're saying that, Jeremy, is how we constantly are so hard on ourselves, and as we should be, because the standard is high. But when we fall and we think, oh, this is the end, there's no way I'm coming back from this, God hates me, he must be looking at me as such a failure. And we read these stories, and these are the people that God chose by hand to make this story happen, and they do all these horrible things and God still brings them back. And quite frankly, I think raping a woman and killing her husband is worse than anything I've ever done. And so I'm looking at David's story and thinking, okay, if he can come back from something like that.
It shows that anybody can, like, and that's why people like nowadays who are like, your God doesn't love us. I'm like, that's the most foolish thing I've ever heard in my life. I was like, and anybody who's a parent can understand this. Like we said this before, anyone who has a child can understand, like, even when your child does bad or does something wrong, you still love them unconditionally. Doesn't mean you agree with them hitting your other child over the head with a plate. You know what I mean? You don't agree with that. You still love them and you care for them and you want them to be the best child that they can be. But like, you're not going to tolerate smashing a plate over someone's head, right? And it's the same concept when we sin, right? Like, God's not going to sit here and be like, oh, it's okay that you go and do the things that you're not supposed to do. Right. No, it's not okay. But God's actually going to use those moments to humble you out, because you're going to realize eventually, and this is what it reminds me, is you're going to realize eventually, like, what you want to do is not, it's not going to work out. Like, you can be in that relationship for 10 years because you lusted over a woman. But guess what? It's not going to work out. And you may not know now, but in 10 years, when you guys break up because you just don't, quote unquote, love each other anymore, like, you'll know. And guess who's going to be waiting for you when you want to come back? And it's going to be God.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't believe in God, then of course you wouldn't think that there's a loving God. But if you do actually believe in a God, and certainly the God of the Bible, then, yeah, if you're reading certain parts of the Bible, you could convince yourself that he's a hateful vengeance God. But if you're deciding to leave out all of the love parts, then, and all of the redemption parts, well, yeah, then it's pretty easy to come to that conclusion. So whether or not it's ignorant or stupid, it's just people that don't understand what God is actually trying to do for us, right? And they don't really understand themselves. Like, they don't understand their own darkness. People that think, even if there is a God, he doesn't really care about us. It's like, well, or don't understand the idea of forgiveness. They haven't recognized their own evil yet.
Yeah.
Right. That's they haven't recognized that the level of forgiveness they need, and the things that they're capable of doing if they didn't have some kind of light in their life, right? Yeah. And so once you realize that what you're capable of without God, you realize why you need that level of forgiveness. And so people that say, oh, God doesn't love us, or anything like that, they haven't recognized their own evil yet.
Yeah. And they get to know who they are, right? You got to figure out who you are as a human, like what you're capable of. And like, it's so bizarre. I've talked to people before. They're like, oh, I'm capable of doing all these things. And I'm like, yeah, you're capable of doing it, but why don't you? Oh, because I have God. I was like, exactly. And that's why we are the way we are, you know? There's a passage, I just want to end it off at this. There's a passage in Luke 7, I can't quote it, but it talks about those who have forgiven more forgive more. And it's about the woman who essentially was like she understood that she's done so much in her life. So then she understands the love and the mercy and the grace that God gives her because of all the things she's done. But if you have someone who has been raised in this environment and they don't really have the same exact mentality as that, like, they haven't done as much, they don't understand it as much, they don't feel it as much. So I think those who've lived a tough life can understand, like, dude, yeah, that stinks that all these things happen to your life, you know, but I'm here with you type of mentality. And I think we all should adapt to that mentality as best as we can.
So to end this off, I'll read Luke 7:36. When one of the Pharisees invited Jesus to have dinner with him, he went to the Pharisee's house and reclined at the table. A woman in that town who lived a sinful life learned that Jesus was eating at the Pharisee's house. So she came there with an alabaster jar of perfume. As she stood behind him at his feet weeping, she began to wet his feet with her tears. Then she wiped them with her hair, kissed them, and poured perfume on them. When the Pharisee who had invited him saw this, he said to himself, "If this man were a prophet, he would know who is touching him and what kind of woman she is, that she is a sinner." Jesus answered him, "Simon, I have something to tell you." "Tell me, teacher," he said. "Two people owed money to a certain moneylender. One owed him 5,000 denarii and the other 50. Neither of them had the money to pay him back. So he forgave the debts of both. Now, which of them will love him more? Simon replied, I suppose the one who had the bigger debt forgiven. You have judged correctly, said Jesus. Then he turned toward the woman and said to Simon, Do you see this woman? I came into your house. You did not give me any water for my feet, but she wet my feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. You did not give me a kiss, but this woman from the time I entered has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not put oil on my head, but she has poured perfume on my feet. Therefore, I tell you, her many sins have been forgiven, as her great love has shown. But whoever has been forgiven little loves little. Then Jesus said to her, Your sins are forgiven. The other guests began to say among themselves, Who is this who even forgives sins? Jesus said to the woman, Your faith has saved you. Go in peace. So that was a great reference that you made there about what level of forgiveness sinful people need.
Yeah.
And so that's a great place to end it.
See how much denarii you owe.
Yeah.
The money.
Yes.
Are you a 500, a 50, 5,000, or 100,000, right?
Exactly. How high do you think your debt is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so everybody, thanks for listening to this episode of Taming Tribulation. We will continue next week with David's story and talking about what a horrible, sinful family that is and how we can learn from them. Thanks, everybody. Bye.